This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
I want to talk about Yeats and form. That's because nobody much mentions it. In the standard commentary on Yeats, it will tell you all sorts of things about a poem, but not that it's a sonnet, not that it's written in ottava rima, not that its lines are hexameters. Nothing. Nothing. The poems exist in a void. In that respect, they could all be prose. And this has bothered me ever since I began teaching Yeats, because there's no easy way of drawing attention to the forms if the students aren't aware that they're there. This is going to be corrected in the next edition of the commentary. I'm glad to say the editors have agreed to put formal notes in as well. Yeats worked very hard on his forms, as you know. He's saying a line will take us hours, maybe. And in order to see what took him hours, it certainly doesn't take hours to make a line. It takes hours to think about making the line. And some of that thought is reflected in the formal shapes that his poems take. I'm taking up three of these tonight. I thought I'd take up one stanza shape, that is to say, the ballad. He wrote ballads from the time he began till the time he died, 50 years worth of ballads. It was an important form for him. After the stanza form, I want to take up a line. It's a line that doesn't occur much in English, and so it's interesting that Yeats used it quite often. That's the six-beat line, the line that we associate with Homer and with Virgil. The hexameter normally reserved for sort of noble things. After doing a stanza and a line, I want to do a unit, less than a whole stanza, and I want to take up the little unit that begins a Petrarchan sonnet, the ABBA quatrain, the quatrain that is made of embraced rhymes, as we call it, two outer lines rhyme and the two inner lines rhyme. But by taking these perfectly inconsiderable things, I hope to show something about how Yeats changed form within a given parameter as he went along, and also to talk about the poems that came out of his experiments and say something about their inner structural form as well. So it couldn't be simpler in its organization. Just to show Yeats at work is my only aim. And I begin with the ballad, as I've said, which Yeats took up for both sentimental and nationalist reasons. You all have the handout. I'll be looking at Yeats's late ballads as well, late ballad, Crazy Jane on the Mountain, but just to show you how he began, I show you an early ballad, The Fiddler of Dooney. And you can see that the couldn't be simpler. It couldn't be more innocuous, you might say, harmless as a poem. When I play on my fiddle in Dooney, folk dance like a wave of the sea. My cousin is priest in Kilvarnet, my brother in Macarabui, and we follow easily the simple narrative that we know from other folk ballads as the fiddler introduces himself and his relatives, his priestly relatives, tracks them after death to St. Peter's Gate, and reveals that he is ushered first into heaven before the two priests, for the good are always the merry, and save by an evil chance, and the merry love the fiddle, and the merry love to dance. And when the folk there spy me, they will all come up to me with, here is the fiddler of Dooney, and dance like a wave of the sea. But by the end of Yeats's life, the winning ballad peasant has mutated into a grotesque, whom he names the Roaring Tinker in one poem. We recognize the Roaring Tinker as a cousin to all of Yeats's other ballad figures by his ballad stanza in Three Songs to the One Burden. So suddenly we've had a mutation by which the fiddler of Dooney turns into this creature. The Roaring Tinker, if you like, but Mannion is my name, and I beat up the common sort and think it is no shame. The common breeds the common, a lout begets a lout, so when I take on half a score, I knock their heads about. Well, this man is sentimentalized in the direction of aggression rather than the direction of pathos, but we can see that Yeats's early country folk are now joined by altogether coarser and more violent figures. In his last and most inclusive ballad, News for the Delphic Oracle, all the living and dead alike, human and mythical, from philosophical golden codgers and Christian holy innocents to classical love-besotted innocents, love-besotted adolescents, Peleus and Thetis, all are brought into one human family, and this heterogeneous population produces a cacophony of style. That's one extreme example of Yeats's late use of the ballad form, but I'm turning now to another such poem, partly because it's another one of his ventures into the grotesque, which are so common in late work. Yeats's saddest and oddest variation on the ballad quatrain occurs in the late poem Crazy Jane on the Mountain, which you have. This is a 22-line poem, which is not printed in ballad stanzas, as you can see, but is rather printed as a solid block. Can anybody see? Should we turn up the lights? Can we turn up the lights a little bit? Maybe? Sorry about that. Ah, good. You can see it's printed as a solid block of 22 lines, but it has no white space showing us stanzas, and the whole poem, all 22 lines, every other line, rhymes on a single sound, a vowel plus the sound N. So if you look down, you can see that unlike most ballads, which have nice new rhymes for each four lines coming up, this one has only one rhyme sound all the way down. Jane, man, on, gone, throne, Jane, ran, man, upon, stone, down. This is a very weird thing to do, of course, and one has to ask oneself why it has been done. The violence of the present is represented in this poem by the execution of the Romanoffs, who were cousins of George VI of England. The primitive past is embodied in the vision of the war hero Cuchulainn and his wife, Ymir, his wife who could, according to the saga, outdo all women in the capacity of her bladder. Caught between today's political murder and transient glimpses of a vanished past, Crazy Jane can do nothing but keen on a single note. The 4-3-4-3, 4 beats, 3 beats, 4 beats, 3 beats, ballad meter has shrunk to 3-2-3-2, yet we feel as we perceive the characteristic rhymes of the second and fourth lines that the poem has located itself within the folk ballad tradition. A normal ballad would continue its story from beginning to end, if you think of Sir Patrick Spens, They All End Up Drowned, but Crazy Jane on the Mountain, in the middle of its third quatrain, starts over, structurally speaking, turning itself into a double portrait of present and past, as you can see. The way you know it's starting over is it starts over. The last night I lay on the mountain, said Crazy Jane, just the way the first two have lines are structured. Many of you know the poem in which Crazy Jane meets the bishop and tells him the fair and foul are near of kin. I'm tired of cursing the bishop, said Crazy Jane. 9 books on 9 hats would not make him a man. I have found something worse to meditate on. The king had some beautiful cousins, but where are they gone? Battered to death in a cellar, and he stuck to his throne. Last night I lay on the mountain, said Crazy Jane. There in a 2-horse carriage that on 2 wheels ran, great-bladdered Ymir sat, her violent man, Cuchulainn, sat at her side. Thereupon, propped upon my 2 knees, I kissed a stone. I lay stretched out in the dirt, and I cried tears down. Following on Crazy Jane's ritual act of homage to the past by kissing a stone, the last 2 lines of the poem serve as the elegy for the past and present alike. The poem, if we look back to early ballads, like the ballad of Father Hart or Father Gilligan or the early ballad, The Fiddler of Dooney, this poem is anything but beautiful, quote-unquote. The ballad tradition is adopted for the denunciation of the present rather than for a continued narrative or a celebration of spontaneity and simplicity, as in The Fiddler of Dooney. Crazy Jane, prostrate and weeping, lacks the energy of the roaring tinker. She has run out of curses and has turned ballad to a moan that cannot deviate from its single rhyme sound. The sophistication of the structure of a diptych plus a coda is matched by the device of reiterated, almost involuntary, invariant rhyme. The decline of harmonic rhyme into one dull monotone, together with the collapse of the quatrains into one fixed block, suggests the disintegration of value mourned in the poem, in the late poems. But Yeats's lifelong variations on the ballad form during 50 years of composition show that he could neither let go of the form nor continue his early use of it in naive folk imitation or in Wordsworthian lyrical ballads. Nor, as we've seen in Crazy Jane on the Mountain, could Yeats resist tinkering with the ballad stanza. He began to use it as time went on as a base unit, so to speak, for other lyric stanzas, often 6-line ones. My example of this creative extension of the ballad stanza, as I say, it rhymes only in lines 2 and lines 4. Lines 1 and 3 don't rhyme in a normal ballad stanza. My example of the extension of this is The Wild Swans at Cool. We recognize, as we listen to its opening lines, the familiar quatrain 4-3-4-3 with the second and fourth lines rhyming. The trees are in their autumn beauty. The woodland paths are dry. Under the October twilight, the water mirrors a still sky. If it ended there, we'd have a ballad stanza. But, of course, it doesn't end there. He appends, in a marvelous move, he appends to the ballad quatrain a long, curling, rhyming couplet, 5 beats followed by 3 beats, phrased almost as an afterthought. Upon the brimming water, among the stones, are 9 and 50 swans. This tantalizing new 6-line stanza, which borrows from the ballad vocabulary not only its naked simplicities, and now my heart is sore, all's changed, but also its fairy tale echoes, 9 and 50 swans. This new stanza distances the poem by its thoughtful lingering couplet from ballad briskness and brings it into the realm of the meditative. Yet the poem remains for 26 of its 30 lines, organized, as a ballad normally is, by a simple narrative, in this case one that oscillates between cool in the present and cool in the past. It's only in the last 4 lines that this poem departs from narrative into speculation about the swans in the unspecified future. Let me read the poem. The trees are in their autumn beauty. The woodland paths are dry. Under the October twilight, the water mirrors a still sky. Upon the brimming water, among the stones, are 9 and 50 swans. The 19th autumn has come upon me since I first made my count. I saw, before I had well finished, all suddenly mount and scatter, wheeling in great broken rings upon their clamorous wings. I have looked upon those brilliant creatures, and now my heart is sore. All's changed. Since I, hearing at twilight the first time on this shore, the bell beat of their wings above my head, trod with a lighter tread. Unwearied still, lover by lover, they paddle in the cold, companionable streams or climb the air. Their hearts have not grown old. Passion or conquest, wander where they will, attend upon them still. But now they drift on the still water, mysterious, beautiful. Among what rushes will they build? By what lake's edge or pool delight men's eyes when I awake someday to find they have flown away? At this moment, we recognize Yeats's inventiveness in the internal structural form of his poem. 2 vectors have structured the poem in its first 4 stanzas and the opening lines of the 5th. The first is the horizontal, eternal, you might say, straight line running from left to right that represents the steady state existence of the swans, ever present, ever young, species immortal, like Keats's nightingale, "Thou wast not born for death, immortal bird." The second vector is the downward slanting line representing the life trajectory of the speaker. Once, 19 years ago, he was young in heart, walked more lightly, felt that passion and conquest were his natural destiny. Now, 19 years later, he's weary and unloved. His heart has grown old and sore. He walks with heavier tread, and neither passion nor conquest attend upon him. If we extrapolate this downward trajectory into the future, we will arrive at its endpoint, the death of the speaker, and yet the swans will still be enjoying their eternal, steady-state, straight-line existence. If the poem had continued to the end, these 2 inaugural trajectories, the steady-state swans versus the declining speaker, the last stanza would have had to read something like this, showing Yeats as dead. I apologize to Yeats. But now they drift on the still water, mysterious, beautiful. Among these rushes they will build, and still, by lake or pool, delight men's eyes when I'm forever gone, silent, etc., beneath a stone. That doesn't happen in the poem, and it's interesting, since you have so firmly the downward trajectory, why it doesn't. The poem completed in this fashion would have affirmed the eternity of nature against the transiency of man, but in one of his most powerful reversals of structural trajectory, Yeats ends the poem not in self-pity at his own death, nor in continual envy of the unchanging swans, but in a generous imagining of larger and more impersonal scope, that the swans, lost to him while he is still alive, will be bestowing their presence on others elsewhere. the old tradition of the translation of the muses. You know, when Whitman wanted to bring the muses over here, he says, close up, please, those immensely overpaint accounts in Ionia and Greece, and declares finally that the muse is here. She's here, installed amid the kitchenware. And so that's the democratic American muse. But this is the translation of the muses in the person of the swans to some other place. They will not be a cool, but they will be elsewhere. We could not have known from the Wordsworthian base of the poem, then versus now, a loss of joy in nature. We could not have foretold this structural swerve into generosity, nor could we have imagined the completion of the ballad stanza by a couplet curving from pentameter exposition into trimeter conclusiveness. In effect, as he imagines the swans delighting other eyes, the poet gives the poem a biological future. Someone else will be still admiring the swans. And we could also hardly imagine that a ballad could give rise to a poem so meditative and lyrical. If one scans the whole of Yeats's output in the ballad stanza and its variants, we can see how useful it is to him in recalling the troubadour origins of lyric, in its adaptability to narrative historical commemoration, as in the 1916 ballads, how useful it is in its stylized naturalness as a vehicle for the vernacular voices of the poor. And it's also useful to him in its potential to generate sequences so that in one ballad sequence called The Three Bushes, after you've read the ballad, all the people walk out and speak their own ballads. And so it becomes an enclosing form for dramatis personae. Yeats was never able to do without this useful form. It serves him well for 50 years. And one of the two last poems he wrote, The Black Tower, is based on a ballad form as well, with a ballad refrain. So much for his use of a stanza, fixing it, tinkering with it, using it for gross and grotesque purposes, as well as for dulcet and singing ones. And I want to turn now to another formal container, the line, in this case the hexameter, to show again, as with the Roaring Tinker and Crazy Jane's Keen on the Mountain, Yeats's willingness to turn the beautiful into the ugly in his pursuit of form. I'll come eventually to some late hexameter poems, but as I did with the ballad stanza, I'll begin with an early use of the form. Everyone knows Yeats's first hexameter lyric, Down by the Sally Gardens. It rhymes in easy couplets, and the caesura, that is to say the break in the middle of the line, drops nicely in the middle of these end-stopped lines. You could imagine the break in the middle of the line, always coming naturally there. Down by the Sally Gardens, my love and I did meet. She passed the Sally Gardens with little snow-white feet. She bid me take love easy as the leaves grow on the tree, but I, being young and foolish, with her would not agree. It couldn't be simpler. But something new happens to Yeats's hexameter line in a poem called The Unappeasable Host, where the caesura, rather than falling nicely into the middle, rather floats within the syntax. And the lines are not end-stopped as in the Sally Gardens, but rove over to the next line. And as he printed the lines, you can see them with the break. But we couldn't read them that way. I'll read it badly with the break evident. Desolate winds that beat the doors of heaven and beat the doors of hell and blow. There are many a whimpering ghost, and clearly that is grotesque. And so he's writing a six-beat line, but you have to sort of float it around. Desolate winds that beat the doors of heaven and beat the doors of hell and blow there many a whimpering ghost. Other such experiments prepare the shockingly irregular hexameters of The Cold Heaven of 1912, in which, really, bizarrely, the medial caesura, can come between two syllables in the middle of a word. I'll read the poem first, then we'll look at the caesuras. This is a poem about self-blame in old age, self-blame for everything going wrong in your life, especially love. Suddenly I saw the cold and rook-delighting heaven that seemed as though ice burned and was but the more ice. And thereupon imagination and heart were driven so wild that every casual thought of that and this vanished and left but memories. that should be out of season with the hot blood of youth, of love crossed long ago. And I took all the blame out of all sense and reason until I cried and trembled and rocked to and fro, riddled with light. Ah, when the ghost begins to quicken, confusion of the deathbed over, is it sent out naked on the roads, as the books say, and stricken by the injustice of the skies for punishment? You can see that, as I've mapped it out in the next part, the caesuras come in very weird places, that is to say, at the hyphens in the middle of a word. Suddenly I saw the cold, that's fine, and rook delighting heaven, that seemed as though ice burned and was but the more ice. And thereupon, imagine, ination and heart were driven, so wild that every cash you will thought of that and this vanished. This is an extraordinary thing to do, to break, to come to the end of the third beat in the middle of a word. Since no one can read in this fashion, stopping in the middle of imagination or casual, the voice is forced into a more colloquial and unmetrical reading of the lines. And since also the alternating rhymes, A-B-A-B, of the cold heaven are less salient than the couplet rhymes of the Sally Gardens, the whole character of the hexameter is made unstable and modern. The hexameter, because of its classical origins and its connection to mythical material as well as epic stories, seemed to Yeats especially suitable for visionary poems, such as The Cold Heaven that we've just seen and The Magi that some of you know. So when we see the hexameter used for a late poem of contemporary vignettes, beautiful, lofty things, we realize, recalling other examples, late examples of the line, that we are to read these hexametrically enumerated things as not only heroic, but also visionary and mythologized. This is a series of vignettes of friends of his. Let me read the poem first. I think perhaps his best poem in six beat lines, along with The Cold Heaven. He's enumerating people at certain places, doing certain things, people he prized terribly highly. Beautiful, lofty things. O'Leary's noble head. My father upon the Abbey stage, before him a raging crowd. This land of saints. And then, as the applause died out, of plaster saints. His beautiful, mischievous head thrown back. Standish O'Grady supporting himself between the tables, speaking to a drunken audience high nonsensical words. Augusta Gregory seated at her great ormolu table, her 80th winter approaching. Yesterday he threatened my life. I told him that nightly from 6 to 7 I sat at this table, the blinds drawn up. Maud gone at Hoth station waiting a train. Pallas Athena in that straight back and arrogant head. All the Olympians, a thing never known again. Now, the hexameters have shed their rhymes, you notice here, but Yeats make up for that lack by repetition of talismanic words, head, beautiful, saints, tables, seated, sat, and above all, things. And he adds another element of pattern in his hexameters, in metrical groups that rhyme, so to speak, with each other. The metrical pattern is echoed, so that we mentally associate the phrases supporting them, making us link these phenomena together. He begins with this little turn, musical turn, beautiful, lofty. And now you have that as the little step or gate of the poem, da-da-da-da-da. And he repeats that, beautiful, lofty, Standish O'Grady, father upon the mischievous head thrown, ormolu table, 80th winter, told him that nightly, Hoth station waiting, Pallas Athena, all the Olympians, thing never known again. But as you hear this, it becomes the signature, the musical signature of the poem. In this short elegy for a cluster of remarkable people whom he had mythologized into emblems of beauty and nobility, Yeats faces the architectonic problem of making a poem out of a list of 5 superficially disparate things. He gives the poem the form of a family cluster. O'Leary, his father in nationalism, the man who told him there are some things a man must not do to save his country. J.B. Yeats, his father in fact and in art. Standish O'Grady, a literary father who had translated the Irish sagas into English. Augusta Gregory, a patroness mother, and Maud Gonne, the beloved sibling and beloved together. In part, the hexameter suits Yeats's purpose here because it's long enough to enfold in a line or two or three a characterizing portrait of each of the five people commemorated. Yeats's decision to present his characters in a theatrical pose, struck for the purpose almost of numismatic impression, led to the poem's participial formulations. Standish show Grady supporting himself, Augusta Gregory seated, Maud Gonne waiting for a train. The formulations of suspended action that we see in the participles is implied as well in the bust-like appearance of O'Leary's head and the poised theatricality of J.B. Yeats upon the Abbey stage. It was during the Playboy of the Western World when there was a riot because somebody talked about a girl being in her shift, and that was thought of as indecency, and then his father got up, this land of saints. They thought he was going to say, shouldn't tolerate such indecency in language of plaster saints. Immobilized in Yeats's memory, yet alive in their speaking, standing, sitting, waiting, these icons of high-strung existence become, in the last line, all the Olympians. As the poem circles back to its beginning, it redefines, to complete its summary, its plural, beautiful, lofty things as a single virtual and visionary thing, never known again. The personal dramatic figures, those vignettes, the personal dramatic figures inhabiting the vignettes are exalted into a collective frieze, an iconic posing of all the Olympians on their now invisible Platonic heights, and the thing becomes the poem, too, that is the frieze that represents them. Unconventional though it may be as an elegiac lyric, beautiful lofty things, even with its irregular hexameters and its colloquialities, a raging crowd, a drunken audience, still seems, in part because of its many adjectives of praise, a beautiful poem. But when Yeats, to oppose the two poles I have of the beautiful and the ugly, too simple, but they're useful, this remains a beautiful and tribute poem. But when Yeats begins in the late Supernatural Songs to expound a heterodox theology, he designs his hexameters to become grotesque and distorted. He takes as his persona a local hermit named Reeve. And Reeve has been living in the Ireland before St. Patrick, when he has a comfortable amalgam of sort of pagan beliefs left over and new Christian beliefs that have sort of come in. And his religion, even though he's nominally a Christian, is basically a kind of pagan one. In comes St. Patrick holding up his shamrock and preaching the Trinity. And Reeve thinks that this is flies in the face of all good pagan wisdom. Reeve denounces Patrick. He says that all trinities should be the biological trinity of man, woman, and child. That's what Reeve thinks. And he doesn't understand how you can have an entirely male generative principle with the male father generating the male son, generating the male Holy Spirit. That's not right, he says. So here are some more Yeatsian hexameters as Reeve speaks denouncing Patrick. An abstract Greek absurdity has crazed the man. Recall that masculine trinity. Man, woman, child, a daughter or a son. That's how all natural or supernatural stories run. Natural and supernatural with the self-same ring are wed. As man, as beast, as an ephemeral fly begets Godhead. And then he cites his authority. For things below are copies, the great Smaragdan tablet said. He's obviously, his authority is not the Gospels or anything like that, but rather the great Smaragdan tablet. However, since these very irregular hexameters, you have to read them strangely to read them as hexameters, but they are. You can see it better. He always establishes the norm somewhere early or late in the poem. For things below are copies, the great Smaragdan tablet said. Natural and supernatural with the self-same ring are wed. But they run all over the place, and they run more all over the place later on. In another one of Reeve's remarks. As Reeve demonstrates this truth of the mythological trinity, which is male, female, and child, rather than the Trinitarian one that St. Patrick is preaching, as he demonstrates his own truth and denounces Patrick, his putatively hexametrical tercets ironically rhyme in Trinitarian threes, A, 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 so that somewhere St. Patrick's going to win because Reeve is already speaking in trinities. And when Reeve actually shows in his fourth song, I think this is the strangest poem Yeats ever wrote, the fourth song of Supernatural Songs, Reeve describes the self-generation of his own mythological trinity, the trinity he prefers, in which the trinity is part God, part human, and part beast. The father, the primordial father, generates the primordial mother, and then together they both beget the primordial next generation, which is half beast, half human. These hexameter tercets indeed burst their bounds as the divine cub is given birth and licked into animation. And this is the, he is the primal father, I guess we could call him. He holds him from desire, all but stops his breathing, lest primordial motherhood forsake his limbs, the child no longer rest, drinking joy, as it were, milk upon his breast. Through light obliterating garden foliage, what magic drum? Down limb and breast, or down that glimmering belly, move his mouth and sinewy tongue. What from the forest came? What beast has licked its young? We are writing this poem to the primitive beat of the magic drum, but it is a Genesis poem. We are in a garden full of foliage. The deformation of the hexameter, as you can see in my little mapping of it down below, has overturned the rule of metrical law altogether, especially in the second last line where you essentially have nine beats, becoming as heterodox as the doctrine it enacts. Reeve's argument is deliberately reductive, as an ephemeral fly begets Godhead, and deliberately bestial with the god's glimmering belly and sinewy tongue. We have come a very long way from the decorous hexameters of the Sally Gardens. To the older Yeats, the visionary realm now seems both exciting and unnatural, as in Crazy Jane on the Mountain. The Yeats of the Celtic Twilight would never have characterized Emer as great-bladdered. Yeats in old age endures the grotesquerie of the visionary and the grotesquerie of the folk ballad for the sake of his sense that age is in itself grotesque, defiantly asserting its heightened imaginative stimulus in a decrepit body by means of an exaggerated rhetoric. In fact, in his last hexameter poem called High Talk, Yeats declares that there is no way to the truth except through exaggeration and hyperbole. In this poem, a sonnet in couplets, the poet explains why he goes upon stilts. The very first letter we have from Yeats when he's about, I don't know, six, says, I have got a pair of stilts. So it was something that he remembered much later in his 70s. It's touching to remember the elevation he must have felt when he got up on the stilts for the first time, so much so that he uses it later in a poem. He was a very precocious child, of course, registering everything. Had his musical ear as a child, too, when a friend of his father's, John Ellis, came to visit, and the little Yeats, who was then four, I think, was introduced to John Ellis. He said, oh, are you related to Cinderella? No, he was already putting sounds together. In High Talk, it's not Xeroxed very well here, but there is in all of Yeats's supervised printings, space not between line 4 and line 5, as there is here. Xeroxing had to cut and paste. But there is a distinct space between line 8 and line 9. We know that we're in the realm of the sonnets when 8 lines are followed by 6 lines with a space in between. But we see this as an odd sonnet, partly because it's in hexameters, but also because it rhymes in couplets. Shakespeare has a sonnet that rhymes in couplets, too, but a truncated sonnet, but it's not the usual rhyme form, as you know, for a sonnet. The normative line here, although it's a hexameter, is a special kind of hexameter. Almost all the lines, not all, have 15 syllables to match the 15-foot stilts that the speaker has fashioned to lengthen his gait. And here it is. He refers in this poem to when Malachi wore the collar of gold, archaic Ireland, when it was still a kingdom of its own. He has thought about other poets' writings, and it seems to him that the other poets are too tame. They haven't dared to take on the grotesquerie of primordial fatherhood solving itself into primordial motherhood. So everything seems flat and rather timid to him, as though they were taking out their circus animals, but they're all led and caged and pent up. Processions that lack high stilts have nothing that catches the eye. What if my great-granddad had a pair that were 20 foot high and mine were but 15 foot? No modern stocks upon hire. Some rogue of the world stole them to patch up a fence or a fire. So he only has the 15-foot ones instead of the nobler, more traditional ones of his great-granddad that were 20 foot high. But he's still pretty high at 15 feet. Because piebald ponies, lead bears, caged lions make but poor shows. Because children demand daddy long legs upon his timber toes. Because women in the upper stories demand a face at the pain that patching old heels they may shriek, I take to chisel and plane. Malachi Stiltjack am I. Whatever I learned has run wild, from collar to collar, from stilt to stilt, from father to child. All metaphor, Malachi, stilts and all. A barnacle goose, far up in the stretches of night. Night splits and the dawn breaks loose. I, through the terrible novelty of light, stalk on, stalk on. Those great seahorses bare their teeth and laugh at the dawn. This strange poem as we might expect from the connection we've seen between the hexameter and the visionary, although this poem begins in a populated village, it ends in a visionary moment when Malachi, turning from self to nature, beholds the waves and is rewarded by a live metaphor. He sees not the waves, but the seahorses of the ocean god Mananan. A verse that stalks, a verse on stilts, becomes Yeats's version of the high epic hexameter. The dismissive tone Malachi uses of his audience of bored women and demanding children matches the equally contemptuous tone he applies to the captured animals here. They are not lions who have temporarily been caged or bears who are for the moment being led, but the bad adjectives are prepositioned so that we see only led bears and caged lions. Yeats has unleashed his contempt for the Irish audience in other poems, but he has not portrayed himself as conforming to their desire for the showy, as Malachi does here. The grotesquerie in the late hexameters stems from the poet's conviction that he is himself a grotesque, that, as he said in a letter, all great men are owls, scarecrows, by the time their fame has come. I just want to mention that these hexameters, as well as being broken in the middle, imitate Malachi's stilt walk. You can see it clearly in from collar to collar, from stilt to stilt, from father to child. And the left, right, goes on in other parts of the poem. I, through the terrible novelty of light, stalk on, stalk on. So that the stilted walk of the high talk goes along with a stilted walk. It's also, besides the fact that it's rhymed in couplets, it departs from the traditional sonnet form because it changes the architectonic structure of the meaning units of the sonnet. Normally we have quatrain, 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 couplet, but here you have quatrain, quatrain, couplet, Malachi Stiltjack am I, and then another quatrain in terms of sense units. So that although the sonnet form lies underneath it, it's being modified in all sorts of grotesque ways. We've seen the ballad and the hexameter as examples of Yeats's exploration of the potential of form and of his willingness to uglify form in the service of expressiveness. I want to close with a form that he used rarely and never uglified, almost one of the few he never uglified, the pentameter Petrarchan quatrain with the embraced rhyme, ABBA. The poem I take as an example is the beautiful late poem of eight lines entitled After Long Silence. It's about a meeting with his first lover, Olivia Shakespeare, in old age after they've not seen each other for a long time. Speech after long silence. It is right, all other lovers being estranged or dead. Unfriendly lamplight hid under its shade, the curtains drawn upon unfriendly night. that we descant and yet again descant upon the supreme theme of art and song. Bodily decrepitude is wisdom. Young, we loved each other and were ignorant. Because it contains only two quatrains, this poem feels like an epigram. Because it reflects on love, the supreme theme of art and song, it reaches back to the earliest roots of the Western lyric, to the troubadours who made love it their chief theme. But although love is a theme historically connected with youth and dawn, Yeats, writing at the age of 64, draws it into the orbit of age, night, and bodily decrepitude. He sent After Long Silence in a letter to Olivia Shakespeare, and it seems to refer, as I said, to a meeting with her after a long separation. It concerns a tryst, not one of sexual intercourse as in youth, but one of intimate conversation in old age. And the title tells us that to converse after long silence with a beloved woman known since youth is like gratefully coming on water after a parched thirst. The poem, because it consists of only one sentence, makes a single unit of its two stanzas, each of which uses embraced rhyme. This means that the ear must wait a long time after hearing the first rhyme word right to encounter its rhyme sound in night, and after hearing descant to find its rhyme sound in ignorant. These long suspensions of conclusiveness are mirrored in the syntax of the poem in the long clause that runs from it is right to art and song, the clause that covers their conversation. The poem consists of four syntactic units, of which three are short and only one is long, the long one being their conversation, their musical descant on love. The first unit, speech after long silence. The second unit, the long one, it is right that we descant upon the supreme theme of art and song. Another very short one, bodily decrepitude is wisdom. And one slightly longer, young, we loved each other and were ignorant. We could give each of these units a name. The present event that is happening. The ratification, it is right, of their mutual action in talk. Then an abstract epigram, bodily decrepitude is wisdom, and finally a narration of the past about when they were young. The most significant proportion of space is given to the justum est, that it is right that we should do this. In short, we're reading not a narrative of the present tryst, but a judgment on it, and on the type of language, a descant or repeated song motif that arises during it. The descant praises love, but with the older knowledge, the after knowledge of wisdom, voicing the poem's closing paradox. The physical tryst of youth has the passion of sex, but is accomplished in ignorance. The metaphysical tryst of old age is sexless, but has attained both the wisdom and the fitting adult and musical language needed to descant adequately on love. The long arc of life summed up in this tryst is suggested by the stately arcs of embraced rhyme and elaborate liturgical syntax that enclose the poem. But how did this poem arise, and how did it acquire form, and what meaning can we ascribe to the form Yeats chose? We have the first draft of this accomplished and courtly poem, and it's startling when one knows the poem to come across its imperfect scrawled beginning. The aging speaker is seated, we're not told where the tryst takes place, and the beloved woman whom he has not seen for years enters. His first reaction is a pang at the physical change in her. She's become unrecognizable. Her hair is turned white. His second reaction is that she must be feeling exactly the same shock, since his hair, too, has turned white since she last saw him. And this is the draft. Your hair is white. My hair is white. Come, let us talk of love. What other theme do we know? When we were young, we were in love with one another and therefore ignorant. We can see that the sustained level of abstraction that prevails in the final poem has all been added in the course of revision. This abstraction arrives in the nouns of the initial contrastive summing up, speech, silence. It develops in the quasi-liturgical judgment, abstractly put, it is right that we descant, and it reaches a bitter wisdom in the epigram. Also added in revision is the precarious temporary safety of the couple who are threatened in interiors by unfriendly lamplight, which would reveal too much of the aging of their faces, though where they sit the light is mercifully shaded, and they are equally threatened outside by unfriendly night, which would signify their approaching death. And the prosodic scheme of the poem has been added, as well as that degree of abstraction that I mentioned. Why did Yeats choose embraced rhymed pentameter quatrains? When we look back through the collected poems for previous appearances of this form, the first example tells us all we need to know. It is Yeats's, as I say, his first use of this form, is Yeats's translation, revision, and reduction from 14 lines to 12 of Ronsard's Petrarchan sonnet, Quand vous serez bien vieille, au soir à la chandelle, when you are very old at evening. The embraced rhymes of After Long Silence take us back then to Petrarch and his European followers. The eight lines are, in fact, the octave of a love sonnet. If the love ballad is the popular folk container for the supreme theme of art and song, the Petrarchan sonnet is the courtly container for the same theme. Yet the sonnet has here in old age been contracted to an octave alone and has embedded within itself, in its third unit, bodily decrepitude is wisdom, that epigrammatic aspect of the sonnet that used in Shakespeare's example to be reserved to the closing couplet. The original narrative organization of the draft has been roughly kept in the final version, the present scene of encounter, the reference to love, the backward look to the past. But the Yeats has introduced now a ghostly circle around them of all other lovers, those to whom he could once have spoken, but who are now, and which of the two words is worse, estranged or dead. Protected by shaded light, the couple can renew speech until Yeats exalts the word for their interchange to descant, by which they enter the realm of song as wisdom is at last blended with the celebration of love. The grim and sententiously unrolling polysyllables of bodily decrepitude is wisdom evaporate in the common and touching words young and ignorant. Although he writes this perfectly equilibrated poem late in life, Yeats feels no need to mangle or uglify his pentameter quatrains. In this protected circle of mutual trust and mutual recollection, voiced entirely in a joint first-person plural, we, they speak as one. Irony can be permitted in the relish with which the poet finds the Latinate decrepitude, wonderful word, and the dismissive and pitying ignorant, but there is enough love left and enough memory of youth to shield these quatrains from violent authorial interference. Our reading of After Long Silence would be poorer, I believe, if we didn't recall its many forms. These include not only its external form, the embraced rhyme and pentameter lines of the Petrarchan sonnet, but also the varying intonational rhythms and levels of abstraction in the lines. Our reading would be poor, too, if we didn't include the internal structuring of the poem, the disproportionate lengths of its units of meaning, the liturgical echo in It Is Right That We, the chiasmus, unfriendly night, light, enclosing the couple, and the poem's sudden change of genre when the bitter epigram of bodily decrepitude intrudes upon and cuts short the ritual descant on love, after which the epigram itself is cut off by a piercing moment of reminiscent narrative. Because we have the first draft of After Long Silence, we can see proof of Yeats's expertise in revising towards meaning-laden form. We can equally feel his courage in the violation of form, where, as in Crazy Jane on the Mountain or the Supernatural Songs or High Talk, it suited his expressive aims to overturn expectation related to the form he was using. He was a modernist poet in his violating of received forms and genres. He was no less a modernist poet in renewing every form he touched. For this reason, each of his significant poems deserves investigation of both its external and its internal inventiveness. Thanks. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Helen, it was a wonderful lecture, and I wanted to pick up on what you started with and ended with too, which was that our readings of Yeats's poems are impoverished if we don't pay attention to these formal structures that you delineated so masterfully. Why is it that so little attention has been paid to Yeats's formal mastery recently?
Well, first of all, because he lived such an exciting life and was in the thick of things, I think, and also because the first people who were interested in him were very much interested in his role in the evolution of a national literature, and not simply in politics, but simply in conceiving a national literature at the Abbey Theatre and elsewhere. And subsequent people began to investigate certain aspects of that interesting life, whether it was his connection with Japanese no plays, or whether it was his interest in Italy, or whether the Georgian houses of Ireland were a particular focus of his interest. And it was more in the sense of cultural studies than study of poetry as such. Not that there weren't many good critics who would mention in passing something about a formal structure here or there, but really about the formal structure of a whole poem. There, Tom Parkinson of Berkeley did a wonderful book on the late poems, in which he was a poet himself, so he really knew what he was talking about. But most critics are not poets and don't feel that the form from the inside, so to speak.
So you see that coming more into focus over time as these rather thematic studies of Yeats have been done, and now it's time to move on to something.
Oh, they do
else.
Them all over again. The revisionists, you know, who have been revising Irish history at a great rate lately, have now begun to revise the historical placement of Yeats too.
Right.
So it never ceases.
Now, Yeats is an icon of Irish nationalism, still, I think, but he was also a very worldly and well-traveled person who spent, I think it was Hugh Kenner who calculated that Yeats spent more time out of Ireland than Joyce, the professional exile, did.
Yeah.
And one of the contexts in which Yeats found himself was avant-garde literary and artistic circles in London. And clearly he was familiar with everything that was going on in the 1910s and 1920s in London, in Europe generally, to do with what we've now come to use the term modernist experimentation to describe. And yet, it's clear that however much Yeats distorted or uglified, to use your beautiful term, the traditional forms of the poems that he was writing, he stayed basically within a clearly recognizable formal structure, whereas other poets that he knew very well, and in the case of Ezra Pound, had actually corrected some of his work for him or had pointed out some stylistic asperity that could be introduced into it. Why is it that a poet like Yeats remains working within those traditional structures and doesn't break the pentameter and move towards a much more radical overthrowing of form until there is, in some senses, no form left?
When he talks in his poem Adam's Curse about quoting precedents out of beautiful old books, I think he thought the old books were beautiful and that it was a risk, perhaps, that he wasn't willing to run to go away from what he perceived as the beautiful, stretching the beautiful as far as you can stretch it into the ugly, but nonetheless, the weight of the forms had been so internalized, I think, by him as a young boy, that he couldn't conceive of a really accomplished poetry that wasn't guided by them. And I think it's true, as people have said, that you can hear the pentameter under everything that Eliot does in Proof Rock or something, that all the poets who wrote for Ivor as well were always coming back somehow to a norm, even if it's a phrasal norm like Pound's, to something that is a kind of recurrent and patterned thing. I don't know. He never said why he didn't take up free verse. I think he thought it a preposterous idea that after all these years of writing,
after all,
he was born in 1865, so he was 35 at the turn of the century, and in his 40s, really, when modernism was going strong.
But there's continued to be a whole tradition at which Yeats really stands at the portals at the beginning of the 20th century of poets much younger than Yeats, many of them not born when Yeats was alive, who use relatively traditional forms. Could you talk a bit about the stylistic choices that poets have available to them now between the model of, say, relatively traditional form and relatively fractured or broken or open forms? Why does this older model survive at the same time as these new forms continue to be generated?
I think it is an exemplification of a form of allegiance. Frost stayed, by and large, within traditional forms too, because he had such an allegiance on the one hand to, you might say, the ballad tradition and on the other hand, to Latin hendecasyllabics, which he writes poems in. I mean, the 11-syllable line of Catullus, etc. And Latin was so firm a grounding for Frost that I think everything he did almost came out of Latin at some level. And the other part is song. Frost said once, when people were doing a lot of those freeform things that they hung on the walls, weavings and whatnot, Frost said, if you're going to make a piece of cloth, make pants out of it. And he couldn't imagine making something, you know, that wasn't useful out of what your text was. And at the same time, I think that the, what shall I say, the allegiance that James Merrill felt towards Greece, which is the fountainhead of all lyric form with those beautifully shaped lyrics, made him think again that form was the ground of verse. And Merrill occasionally wrote in free verse too, but he wrote an awful lot of formal shaped verse. So that I think it depends on where your allegiances lie.
Right. Merrill is a really interesting example to compare with Yeats too, because they do seem to be the two poets of the 20th century, loosely speaking, who were most interested in the supernatural. And yet the supernatural in Yeats's work is aligned with this heightening of language and the formal tensions within the traditional forms. And yet people think of James Merrill as a formalist, and yet the supernatural really broke open his poetry. So you have a kind of two antithetical models of what the other world could do to poetic form.
I think it's a different form because Yeats did use the Ouija board, and Merrill did. So that when you're copying down those letters one after the other, and I've seen Merrill's big notebooks, where really you can't tell where one word ends and the other begins until he goes back and looks at all the letters they've put down and then puts strikes between the words to delineate the words. He then did an immense amount of editing on the notebooks. But Yeats got his otherworldliness from his wife's mouth, so to speak, when she was being a medium and doing automatic writing. And there I think you don't have that fragmentation that comes about through the strange spelling and the and so
yes.
forth in Merrill. I think there is a difference in medium there, the medium in every sense of the word.
Right. Two mediums, yeah.
But also I think sometimes they're jeered at for doing this, but I do think that all poets look for some way to do an end run around the censoring conscious intellect. And the ones who aren't drinkers, as Merrill wasn't and as Yeats wasn't, have to find some other way of deregulating the senses. And automatic writing and Ouija board things are very good for getting around the corners of your mind, I expect. So haven't done it myself, but I expect.
Right. So presumably that's where Frost's pants would come in, too, that he had a he had a strange shape for his trousers. I wanted to try and talk in more general terms about what Yeats calls responsibilities in his title of his 1914 collection, Responsibilities. And clearly Yeats was a person who felt great responsibilities not only to his poetry, but to his country, to the various spheres in which he found himself immersed in. He was a very, very active man, a very worldly man, involved with a great deal of theater business, politics, and so on and so forth. You've written that the ethics of lyric writing lies in the accuracy of its representation of the inner life and in that alone. How do poets negotiate between those ethical responsibilities that they might feel as citizens and that some people feel that they see in the poems of Yeats and that inner life that lyric poetry represents?
Well, this has been a crisis for any number of poets, as we all know. And a student is writing a dissertation at Harvard now, attacking the notion that one can talk about this at all in general terms, the poet, the art, the social responsibility, and so on, and simply saying that each poet whose life ends up being traversed by politics and who ends up having a public role negotiates that in an individual way, so that the way Yeats negotiated it might not be the way Miłosz has negotiated it. I think Yeats negotiated it by doing an immense amount of prose, so that the prose really takes up a lot of the burden of responsibility, and every one of his prose pieces has a manifesto in it somewhere. Mm. So there's a lot of stuff pouring out of him in essays, in letters to the editor, which he wrote millions of, in position papers, in all of those things. That left him, I think, freer, perhaps, than a poet who didn't write any prose would find himself in writing the poetry. But in writing the poetry, he admirably fed public events into his own sensibility and struggled with his own sensibility in order to make them into poetry. He doesn't always succeed. There are some of the 1916 ballads that I think are not so good. Mm. But in a great poem like 1916, he does take on a responsibility of trying to understand the revolutionaries. First, he understands them hostily, but then he tries to understand them within terms that mean something to him. So he thinks about them as dreamers. He thinks about them as visionaries. He thinks about them as people who have been bewildered by an excessive love. He understands dreamers and visionaries and people who are bewildered by love. He doesn't understand ideologues. So he has to find some way to bring them under the umbrella of his own sensibility and think about those qualities in them before he can celebrate them. I think he does that with all the political poems.
How does it work itself out for an American poet? Yeats and Milos both belong to very turbulent moments in the European countries' separate histories, where history may seem to have assumed a very visible and obvious form. But for many American writers today, history is not so palpable and immediate. How do contemporary American poets negotiate or filter into their work that political charge that you've talked about?
Well, it may not be with world events like a revolution or something like that, but I think of a current instance that moved me. It's a poem, the name of which I can't remember offhand. Maybe somebody knows it. It's the second last poem in Jory Graham's new book, Never, and it's about the condition of homelessness. But you can't just say having homeless people on the street is bad. I mean, that won't work as a poem. But in the poem, the speaker of the poem, who is not very largely identified, has been walking back and forth every day and noticing a homeless woman who notices her in return, and the glances exchange. The poet doesn't look away, the homeless woman doesn't look away. There's a long description of the homeless woman with all her bundles of rags and whatnot and wrappings around her head. Then nothing more has happened but the exchange of glances, but the poet says, I felt scripted in, as though somehow the exchange could not be ignored. Mm. And then one night, the poet is coming back from a visit to the emergency room at the hospital at 5 in the morning and is carrying a paper bag rattling in the terrible wind that's blowing with a prescription inside it. And as she comes, she sees the woman lying down in a doorway. And she also sees that the woman has a sleeping bag that she seems to be sleeping in, but the one flap of the sleeping bag has come back and the wind has blown it back, and there's this cutting and terrible wind, and she feels she must do something, and she bends down to try to just restore the flap of the sleeping bag, and as she touches it, she realizes that it's not the woman who's there at all. It's a simulacrum of the woman, bundles and a face painted crudely onto a kind of a piece of cloth, pillowcase or something, so that the woman place can be kept, so that she can come back and sleep in that doorway she has made, this simulacrum of herself. And the reactive shock of thinking you are reaching out to cover up a human body and finding out it's a kind of puppet of rags is in itself so shocking that the poet is thrown back on, how can this be happening? And it's after all of the long build-up that the how can this be that people are keeping places for themselves in doorways, which doesn't phrase it so explicitly, but her connection with it is both intensified and broken by that incident. I think of that as a way of treating social conditions that seem to me credible.
Yes, yes. Can I bring up something with you that you've written that agonizes me?
Oh, yeah?
I've worried a lot about this. The statement is as follows. Lyric poetry, especially highly conventionalized lyric of the sort represented by Shakespeare's sonnets, has almost no significant freight of meaning at all in our ordinary sense of the word meaning. And just to fill in the context, what you're talking about there is the prose paraphrases that people can make of a poem usually come down to three or four different variants. I'm sad, my girlfriend has left me, it's cold tonight, things are bad in the world today. The prose content of poetry is relatively meager. So if poetry has no significant freight of meaning at all, why do we keep reading poetry?
I think because the usual words we use, cold tonight or my girlfriend has gone, seem massively inadequate to the situation and the feelings that the situation has made arise in us. I love this poem by Frank O'Hara that I love called Blocks. It's about falling in love. And in the middle, early on, in fact, it says, it reduces the whole love relation to, I want you, you want me, yum, yum. It's a perfect illustration of this business about the freight of meaning. I mean, that's what all of Shakespeare's sonnets are saying,
right.
Too.
Yum, yum.
Yum, yum,
yum.
Whatever. And, but we feel that when we're in love, that it is not enough to say yum, yum. And that the complex of feeling that any significant life motion or event awakes in us is illimitable. And we feel so frustrated, at least I always felt very frustrated, at my own inability to say anything except I'm depressed or I'm overworked or whatever. Mm. Bad things, also good things, there are some good things. But it feels so inadequate, the words that you have for daily life. And I felt that most when I embarked on motherhood and found there were no poems about it, because the dead white males, etc., had not written poems about motherhood. And I felt, how can I possibly go through this without anybody giving me any words to tell me what I'm experiencing? And it's true that there remains a very small selection of very good poems about motherhood, and that some people who are mothers, Adrienne Rich, I think she's never written about her three sons or anything about being a mother, except in prose, they have woman born. But it doesn't enter the poetry. So that I really feel that there are many subjects, as yet untreated, which suddenly come into verbal treatment. There's been a lot of HIV poetry, for instance, that has suddenly come up. And that has been all the way from good to bad. And Doug Powell is the poet I like best in this respect. But you wait for somebody to give voice to the mixture of feelings. And it's feelings that are represented by poems, not meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And the feelings are so wonderfully infinite that they can go on forever.
Talking of dead white males, as you just were, can we go back to the chair of the Harvard English Department? You faced a lot of very substantial obstacles in your progress towards poetry and to being a poetry critic. What was it like at Harvard at that time for somebody like you, a woman who wanted to write about poetry in a very masculine world?
Well, there were nice people and there were awful people. And the nice people, the faculty, of course, was all male at the time. The nice people encouraged the women as much as they did the men, sponsored them as happily and as eagerly. And I was lucky to have my two dissertation directors, Reuben Brower and John Kelleher, sponsor me as fully as anyone possibly could. In fact, John Kelleher, they had a rule at that time at Harvard that you had to wait for 3 years after finishing your thesis to give it to the Harvard Press so that everybody just wouldn't automatically slide their unrevised thesis over to the desks of the editors. And I was up in Ithaca with a new baby when I got a call from the Harvard Press saying, we want to see your thesis. And I said, oh, you can't see it yet. It hasn't been finished for 3 years. And they said, no, we want to see your thesis. And it was because John Kelleher had mentioned it to them, and that was my first book. Mm. So these, those two and others in the department as well, Perry Miller, asked me for my seminar paper that I had written for him in my first term of graduate school. And he said, I want to publish this. And I thought, who are you? I mean, I want to publish this? Are you a publication person? I was so naive, I didn't know. So I went up to see him, and it turned out he was the editor of the New England Quarterly, and I decided this would be fodder for his magazine.
Right.
But again, that was my first article, and that was a way of helping me along, too. So and innumerable, of course, references for fellowships and this and that, that chain of recommendations that we all are part of. Mm. So there were people who were willing to sponsor you in one way or another. Perry Miller would not let any women into his seminar at the time, though I asked to be admitted to his Melville seminar, and he had liked my work. He said, boys and I are together in my house, and we don't sit and drink, and we couldn't talk the way we want to talk. There were any women around. There's no way. And yet he had been kind to me in that other way. So you took your luck where you found it,
right.
I think.
Right. Clearly. Yeah. Did you ever feel like your career had a representative significance, that, you know, you were also writing on behalf of a lot of people, a lot of women who hadn't been given much chance to become poetry critics? Did you see a larger significance in your career, or feel an extra pressure of silent voices over your shoulders?
Well, I felt that because my mother, who was the poetry lover in our house, had not had as good an education as she should have had. She went to Boston State Teachers College, Boston Normal School, as it was then called, became a primary school teacher. But she was sitting around and reading Tennyson and Hopkins. And so, in one sense, she had no outlet for her own talents. Also, she was not able to teach after she married, after she had been 14 years a primary school teacher. Married women were not allowed to teach in the Boston school system because you were taking bread out of a breadwinner's mouth. So she lost her job, and she lost her associations with other teachers. And when I later reviewed notable American women for the New York Times, I realized, as I read biography after biography, mini biography after mini biography of these women who had become notable, that for every one who had risen above the catastrophes that made them notable, usually the loss of a husband or the loss of a father, something that plunged them into having to support themselves, write, do something else, invent something or other, go on the stage. These women, the notable ones, were, you know, the tiny peak of the iceberg, and under those catastrophes of the loss of husband, loss of money, loss of father, terrible disease, whatever, everybody else sank. So that I did feel that anybody who managed to swim rather than sink was the exception rather than the rule. Mm. This has changed somewhat, but it still goes on all the time, that people do not find the opportunities that help them. I was lucky in growing up in Boston. I began going to Harvard when I was 15 for poetry readings, and I got to feel very proprietary about the place, so I was very glad when I went back there when I was 23.
So it was your mother that really led you towards poetry, sensitized you to the language of poetry. Your father was also verbal in a different sense, wasn't he? He was a teacher of foreign
languages. He was a high school teacher of Romance languages, and he taught us Spanish and French and Italian when we were little, and beginning with Spanish, in which he was bilingual because he had lived for a long time in Puerto Rico and Cuba, and then moving on to French, moving on to Italian. And he had a great relish for the sounds of foreign languages. I mean, he thought they were beautiful. He sometimes gave us poems to read, but I remember most particularly when I was very young, we used to get books for Christmas, not presents, therefore you see me here. And we got a book of Italian stories for children, and I remember my father picking it up and looking at it and then saying, "Listen to this, what a wonderful sentence," and only said, "They got their Christmas presents from their grandmother." I mean, it was not a sentence freighted with meaning, but it was, "E la nonna che le ha dato tutto questo per Natale." And my father could just hear the Italianate rhythms, and I think that got conveyed, too.
Do you see that coming out in that ability of yours to look at a poem as a structure, almost separate from its message, "My girlfriend has gone"? As something, a linguistic artifact that you can begin to analyze into its component parts?
I think I actually got that from math and chemistry, not from language.
It may not be well known to a lot of people that you're actually a BA in chemistry.
I am, for reasons I won't go into, but but I loved chemistry when I took the first year of chemistry as a requirement. You had to have a year of science, and it was inorganic chemistry, of course, and then I liked it so much that I went on and took organic chemistry as an elective, which I think is not what everybody would do. But I had already perceived through inorganic chemistry and little hints that there was something in organic chemistry that would speak to me, and it did. It was all those structures, those wonderful things, everything from the benzene ring on. And the three-dimensionality of organic structures was very interesting to me. And the number of permutations and combinations that you could do with, you know, a simple carbon ring and a few things tacked onto it was astonishing. And I loved it in mathematics, too, that not the geometrical side, but the fact that you could represent an equation with a graph of a parabola or something. I don't know why this enthralled me now, but the fact that everything could be visually represented as a structure, even though it only said x plus y equals something or other. I just love those structures. My reading hadn't given me structures. Mm. It gave me thoughts and rhythms and things like that, but my family had no sense of structure in every sense of the word. I mean, they didn't think in terms of logical. They were far more rhetorical in that way.
Well, it's reminding me of a poem that you've written about beautifully, Lowell's epilogue, which begins, those blessed structures, prose and rhyme.
Plot.
Plot and rhyme. Why are they no use to me now?
Mm-hmm. And Lowell went back and forth between formal patterns and non-formal patterns, and he was shocked, really, when he realized he had run out of sonnets after writing hundreds of them, and wanted to write more poems and didn't know how to write them exactly. And those blessed structures, plot and rhyme, and let you hang some words on them. Why are they no use to me now? I want to make something imagined, not recalled. And he ends that poem making the analog between the kind of traditional form that he wishes he could write in, which he compares to the Vermeer girl reading a letter, and his own lurid, garish group snapshots. But when he says, but why not say what happened? He liberates himself from comparing himself to Vermeer and then says, pray for the grace of accuracy. And I think it's the accuracy of depiction that links him, finally, he feels, with Vermeer, that they both tried to set down life in the contour in which they saw it as exactly as possible.
It's a beautiful ending to the poem, and perhaps that would be a good place for us to end tonight. It's been wonderful to hear you lecture and to hear you talk. So thank you very much indeed, Helen Vembler.
Thank you. Thank you all.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.